in the modern civil rights era, we would not be in this moment today without that extraordinary vision, but also that extraordinary risk-taking. The violence was persistent, and the courage was phenomenal.
Martha Jones, we want to thank you so much for being with us. There is so much more to talk about, but August 26th is the actual congressional certification, the 100th anniversary of the Congress certifying the 19th Amendment, and we'll continue the conversation then. Martha Jones, author of the forthcoming book, Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. That does it for our broadcast. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guster, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tommy Warnoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week we feature two recordings with one of the leading voices of the second wave of feminism, Kate Millett.
If revolution is music, ultimately, and not war, if revolution is music, an army of lovers not only can't fail, but they could convert revolution into music, into the power of Eros, and in fact, really, what was it we wanted to bring to this place anyway, if it wasn't love?
Kate Millett was born in Minnesota, where she received her undergraduate degree, and then mostly made New York her home. Her body of work in art, literature, and activism has been instrumental in shaping the second wave of feminism. Millett is probably best known for her doctoral thesis-turned-bestselling book, Sexual Politics, in 1970, but she has written many influential books, including The Prostitution Papers, Flying, Mother Millett, about her relationship with her mother, and The Loony Bin Trip, about her involuntary psychiatric care and institutionalization. Between 2011 and 2013, she has won the Lambda Pioneer Award for Literature, Yoko Ono's Courage Award for the Arts, and was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Pacifica Radio has been present over the years to capture several important recordings of Kate Millett. In this episode, we visit two different programs. In the second half of the program, we'll hear from Kate Millett in an interview with WBAI host Mario Murillo at WBAI at the time of her Loony Bin Trip book release in 1990. But we begin with the 1978 recording of Kate Millett, reflecting on several decades of activism from the pre-Stonewall days to the present of 1978, produced by friend and colleague Helene Rosenbluth. So here's Kate Millett at the Gay Academic Union Conference in November of 1978.
We all look so happy. But in fact, we are doing a strange and terrible thing. We have a feeling that we are, and this is a wonderful feeling that human beings rarely have, we feel that we are creating our freedom, defining it, forming it as we go along, discovering, in fact, and this is the complexity of the governance and oppression of human life, we are even defining what it is to be free. We have found, in the same way that we are striving under the notion, say, of the rubric of liberation, not only we are fighting for rights and freedom, liberation carries one further than that. It is, in a sense, more positive. Rights are involved with don't step on my foot kind of thing. The assumption is government has certain rights over you, the king, and so forth. So you say to the king, well, you know, like, that won't do. There comes a time in human events, and we are insisting upon these rights. But it is essentially a negative definition, if you follow me. The 19th century definitions of freedom were more, say, of the plane, of space, all the way perhaps to existential definitions of freedom, where freedom was a vast amorphous thing one went out and found. When you take liberation, which is the third definition within two or three centuries of, we're still stuck with the word freedom, of the realization of the individual, the notion of liberation is more psychological than the other two, more psychic, more ecstatic, more almost mystical. It is now taking a much stronger position against government and institutions and how they limit the life of the individual. But at the same time, it reaches towards definitions of human self-realization which had scarcely ever been formulated before. That is, under present patriarchal structure. Understanding all that. I kind of ran away. That was a digression. At any rate, to be in this position that we're in, few have ever had that chance. There is a miraculous, almost heady, almost euphoric thing that we know. Not only that we are making history, but we know that we know that we are making history. That is really wonderful sort of thing to be in. I wanted to quote a little definition of some of this that I found in a book, and it's in the beginning of John Lauritzen and David Thorsted's book on the early homosexual rights movement. If anything, I'm really just an advertisement for this book today. And this little bit that was written by Sue and Tommy at the Times Change Press. Well, now we all know who. But what they say, I think, is very charming. We specialize in what we know best. They're speaking of the many kinds of revolution, political, economic, those of a race, class, and so forth. And they speak of where they work in the general movement for freedom. We specialize in what we know best and follow our feeling that the power of the corporate military state is an outgrowth of people being robbed of and unwittingly giving up their power over their own lives. People internalize the oppressor, judge, repress, and punish ourselves and each other, attend more to egomaniacal fantasies than to reality. We want to help people transcend self-hatred and self-importance, guilt and blame, constant distraction, and the blindness caused by emotional and moral judgments. We believe people can recreate their freedom from resources within their own lives, and in so doing, recapture their power from those who have taken possession of it and use it to their own advantage. And our job then is clarifying, and this I found very interesting. I liked their phrasing just here, clarifying unrecognized expressions of unfreedom. Now I admit as an English teacher there are a lot of uns in there, but I'll do it again. Clarifying unrecognized expressions of unfreedom, examining power relationships as closely, interrelatedly, and comprehensively as possible, approaching liberation from diverse perspectives and contributing information and beauty, nice word, to a growing culture that celebrates our successes. Well, here is sort of where we are, celebrating our successes and trying to create beauty. We are really sort of in the eye of the whirlwind, though. It has all happened to us so fast. We still keep thinking that we started at Stonewall or something like that, you know. Sometimes, if I look back the long file of the years I've spent in the women's movement, I can remember the day the gay movement joined into that river. We are, if you like, though, if you look back, we are a people, and that goes a long, long way back. We have been hidden, persecuted, we have committed a crime too dastardly or beastly to even speak its name, and therefore when it's bad, when it's described in laws and codes and so forth, they don't even describe it. I thought it would be interesting if we described it a bit, you know? Now, heaped under the general, you know, sort of pile of sodomy is not only bestiality, but all forms of anal and oral intercourse, also practiced by the straight people very quietly, laws against that. And when you think about it, isn't it fascinating that they have done all these bizarre things like burn us to death, make laws against us, and the main thing is, you see, that you can't ever mention what they're talking about. That it's always about something else. That you're supposed to talk about abstractions. I thought it'd be interesting if we talked about realities. And I would always sort of keep that before their eyes. As a visual artist, I have been doing lots of lately. And I was surprised, drawing with my Japanese brush, millions of them, years and years of them. I even got anatomical books, you know. In addition to photographs, I thought, well, you know, all this business about waiting for everything to get developed and in your mind wanders, if you know what I mean. the anatomicals would help me out. And how amazing and interesting this organ is. How charming, especially the little urethra that just sort of, you know, pops out and looks at you and so on. Here we are, what a state we're in, you know. I realized that I had never seen a picture of this before in my life until I got out these anatomical manuals, and two of my friends, Betty Dotson and Judy Chicago, are painting the same lovely subject. And I thought, here we are, you know, there are of course others, but I only know two other people in the whole world that are doing my subject matter. What painter can say this, you know? This is what you call new ground in the arts, and it is lovely. You see, in other words, underlying all of their craziness is the fact that not only couldn't speak its name, couldn't draw itself, couldn't picture itself up, how we are changing this, how we are demystifying, not at the abstract level where we usually talk about new scholarship or theory or something, but as it were, the facts of life, the sweetness of the flesh. I would like to remind people who get too abstract, you must always concentrate on the sweetness of the flesh. This is one of the reasons we're here, you know? I would think a very major one, in fact. I used to think that that we were 9 years old, from Stonewall to Briggs, then upon reading David Thorstedt and John Retson, I discovered we are 100 years old, and I almost knew that, but I too had forgotten history, that we are in fact a second wave of gay liberationists. As a feminist, I've always been conscious of being the second wave in feminism. But the same thing has happened with us as gays as happened with feminists. Our history has been stolen and suppressed. Stolen by and suppressed by really sort of crummy people. The quality of your enemies always gives you a special elan sometimes. By Stalinism, as we all recall, the 1917 revolution abolished the homosexuality paragraph, the old czarist paragraph, and it also freed everyone to divorce, have abortions, do what they liked. The state no longer interfered in private morality or sexual life. Over the years under Stalin, that was eroded, and we ended up, you know, with the mother of 13 sons of the Red Army who could all go get killed by the other guy, Hitler, who in his struggle for moral purity managed to create concentration camps just for us, and then the lie was sent out that the head of the brown shirts was a homosexual, and therefore, you see, it was really part of decadence. In fact, decadence and bourgeoisie decadence for both groups represented homosexuality. And we have had very much the same way in which feminism was put into a decline by the Depression, by the Second World War, by the rise of fascism, by the rise of totalitarian governments in general, especially against the coming of another terrible war, The same way the gay movement, which had made a great deal of progress, was also retired, buried, locked up. And how all things conspire in one of these terrible convulsions, such as the onset of the Second World War represented, to, you can see it in Japan, you can see it all over the world, how socialists, feminists, gay people, Jews, minorities of all kinds, all the dissenters are all put in one well, or because that's how they did it in Tokyo during the great earthquake, they drowned them, or concentration camps, or whatever it is where you are bottled up, put through red scares. These things are continuous patterns in the struggle within a falling patriarchy to reassert itself against the struggle of a movement to free us from the general structure itself. Sometimes this is like a cliffhanger, you know, but it's all for real. The German pioneers who began the gay movement were interesting people. We should know more about them. I think we should love them and see them as our continuous founders, the way we see the great women of the early feminist movement. Probably it began with Bankert's open letter against the imposition of a new paragraph condemning homosexuals in the criminal law in Prussia in 1871. And this very brave man wrote an open letter, which received enormous attention, deploring this, defending homosexuality in very courageous terms. At the same time, another German, Ulrich, was making theories and agitating for freedom for homosexuals. Some of these theories are interesting. As a historian, they're kind of curious. Ulrich believed that homosexuals were a third sex. He called them the Uraniums, because in Plato, there is a reference to the muse of Urania is the muse of, in the Symposium, what is called the beautiful love, and so on and so forth, homosexual love. So if you go back and you study all the mad notions of Havelock Ellis and Ulrich and all the rest, you're amused, you're confused, because so many of the same notions are still, in fact, rampant. Even if we don't think we're a third sex, very, very, very many gay people think they were born gay, that it is congenital, if not inherited, that they knew from day one, and so on and so on and so forth. And this was a theory that Magnus Hirschfeld, the great hero of the early gay movement, he always held to this and broke with Friedlander, who they had their quarrels, as you know. All liberation movements have two theories at least, if not seven. And then, you know, they have a big meeting where they all break away and go off mad at each other and then issue declarations against each other and so forth. Hirschfeld, though, did all his life lecturing everywhere in the world, and almost single-handedly through these lectures, which would be enormously attended, usually with riots, sometimes with Hirschfeld himself being attacked and once left in the road for dead because they had fractured his skull. Over and over the years, he formed organizations, all the, you know, tiring, terrible bureaucratic work that you have to do if you're going to make a liberation movement. All that stationery, all those stamps, the bones of it, you know? So he founded the Scientific Humanitarian Committee in 1897, and it proceeded apace and organized all over Europe, a big movement in England as well as in Germany, with repercussions everywhere. But if you look beyond, say, just organized movement, we have a much longer history even than that. We have been in all the dark corners in medieval pictures, somewhere in those Hollywood movies they made about Spartacus, through all the visual and literary representations of history, and in all the times it was never mentioned, we were there, somewhere. We were the forbidden people, the crazed ones, the joyous sensualists, the gay people. How nice of the French to call us the gay people, even though it hasn't always been so gay. We were always the dissenters, the hidden subversives. We were the faggots who burned with witches, and that is where the term comes from being laid out as Attila used to often do with his victims too, but here by the church, human bodies put under the human body of the witch, and these like logs, these terrible subversives were the only people wonderful, terrifying enough, bad enough, evil enough, mysterious enough, threatening enough to be burned with the witch herself. There are millions of people who died in these ways, millions of people who underwent torture. We are a long, really suffering file of humanity for all our happy sinning. We are the eyes that stare out still and watch through the flames. Think of those eyes sometimes. Think of what it must have been like to burn to death. What a dreadful way to die. What to see the people watching you, the people who stone you. Remember that underneath what we call oppression was even the horrors of execution, the horrors of torture, the most terrible crimes that human beings can commit against each other because it is said this person made love to another person. Think of how crazy that is. We are the subversives in patriarchy all along. We have always been the ones who bring change. And are they ever afraid of it? As Zola put it for all of us very beautifully, he was one of our supporters, wrote letters to Hirschfeld and stuff. Zola put it to Hirschfeld this way: homosexuality is a disorganization of the family, of the nation, of humanity. Well, how could you do better? And these first reformers between 1864 and 1935, who you can read about, you know, at great and really scholarly length in Lorentzen and Thorsted, they did what we do. They had petitions, committees. They had all their wonderful mad theories. Hirschfeld's notion of inborn homosexuality, by the way, has just been confirmed by the Pope. See how these things go around, you know? As intellectuals, we should amuse ourselves with this. The Pope thinks that if you're an inborn homosexual and born that way, it's okay. But if you're a pseudo and you just do it for the fun... Now, where do you get this identity card, you know? Does it come on your birth certificate? There's another thing in Lorentzen and Thorsted that I love, and that is the pictures. There are pictures of Baron von this and so-and-so Maria, what you call it, the other, and they're in drag. And I thought about it. Gee, drag way back then, you know? Drag is very subversive. I could see its tremendous importance because, you see, all the ways that people are kept in these crazy categories of masculine and feminine on which the system runs and works, the roles, the status, all the rest of it, what if you erase this stuff? And what if you say, okay, you know, biological gender, the way your body looks, the way this person's body looks, and so forth, doesn't mean anything at all in the realm of temperament, psychology, or social standing. But what if you just even say, and you know what, all these costumes you make up, and if you see them as costumes, just as gesture, everything is gesture, make the wrong gesture, you know, Nancy your way through life, you know, you may get a brickbat. How mad they are with imposing that behavior. That's how they keep you in line. Now, what if you went around in dresses? What if you... I think this will have to become a greater practice. The Chinese have been walking around for dresses for years. Japanese women have been wearing this little mompe that they wear to pick the rice in for ages and ages. The absurdity, the metaphysic absurdity of clothing, which is after all only artifact and aesthetic expression anyway, you see. Aestheticize everything, it becomes obvious that it has no moral value. And why should it have a political one, you know? So there is a further subversion, of course, at the very core of the thing, and that is the once the once absolute barrier between persons, that is their sexes, their biological gender, is now being, through surgery, completely changed as well. People can decide they want to be another sex. Well, why indeed not? In a way, transsexism is sort of the miscegenation, as it were, if you follow me, of this particular movement. And as interesting, when you're a little kid, you know, and you can be the other sex in your mind anytime you want to be Tom Sawyer, of course you are. When there is that freedom, the freedom that's represented, say, in As You Like It, where everybody, where Katharine Hepburn puts on her tights and plays, Rosalind in the Forest of Arden, this sort of amazing freedom to transcend all these categories, which are made so ironclad and also so oppressive, but even just so severe, so wall-like, so brick wall-like in our lives. Orlando is another example of that for me. How to transcend all these things at the same time illustrating their absurdity and their complete arbitrariness in the way, in fact, in which we want to live, and their, well, silly but cruel and stupid too, way in which they have controlled our sensibility, our activity, our association, all of our lives, no matter how we think we have transcended them. We grew up with all this. Also, these early reformers were feminists and socialists. I'm supposed to, at this point, remember to say that this is the 50th anniversary of the Militant, and I hope you will celebrate it a great deal and subscribe and support the rest of it. But with socialism, there was always the kind of uneasy bedfellow, as it were, fellow, I say, between feminism and socialism, in that socialism would support us while we supported it entirely. And there has been some of the same problems with the gay movement too, because both socialists regarding gays and regarding feminists have come out of an absolutely patriarchal structure, which they have not yet examined in terms of our perspective, and won't probably for a while, although they are beginning. We also tried to become free through science, and we got the help of a lot of psychologists. That's tricky. I've always thought that was awfully tricky. Hirschfeld built an institute for sexual science in Prince Hatfield's palace. They had liberated it. And long before Kinsey in 1919, there was a university of sex, if you will. We have a university of everything else, you know. We have war colleges, why not sex ones? Certainly a big topic worthy of study, only just beginning on it, in fact. And all this culminated in the World League for Sexual Reform with 130,000 members, and then it all disappeared. Amazing, isn't it? Then came the anti-Semites. Hirschfeld was a Jew. Wilde's trial in England. And the turning back on all sides. We are aware of that in our time, too. Stalinism, Nazism, the war, the pattern. Think about that pattern. Think about what it must have been like the night that they raided the joint. First of all, they sent the students in, because the students can also become reactionaries, and they're wonderful at breaking things up. This is a description of how it was. At 9:30 a.m., the students, the lorries drew up in front of the Institute for Sexual Studies, and about 100 students and a brass band. Whenever the Nazis took over a building, they always brought a brass band, and they were as drunk as they could be, although 9:30 is early. They drew up in military formation in front of the Institute and then marched into the building with their band playing. It was a real description of barbarism. As the office was not yet open, there was no responsible person there. There were a few women and one man. The students demanded admittance to every room and broke in the doors of those which were closed, including the office of the World League for Sexual Reform. When they found that there was not too much to be had in the lower rooms, they made their way up to the first floor, where they emptied the ink bottles over manuscripts and carpets and then made for the bookcases. They took away whatever they thought not completely unobjectionable, working for the most part on the basis of the so-called blacklist. But they went beyond this and took other books also, including an example, for example, a large work on Tutankhamun. Well, you never know. And a number of art journals, which they found among the secretary's private books. Then they removed from the archives the large charts dealing with intersexual cases. You see, I said it was subversive, which had been prepared for the International Medical Congress held at the Kingston Museum in London in 1913. They threw most of the charts through the windows to their comrades who were standing outside. The staff was kept under observation during the whole of the proceeding, and the band played throughout, so that a large crowd of inquisitive people gathered outside. At 12 o'clock, the leader made a long speech, and then the gang left, singing a particularly vulgar song. Envy, isn't it? And also the Horst Wessel song. At 3 o'clock, a number of truckloads of stormtroopers showed up. Now we get the real police, and announced that they were going to continue the work begun that morning. The second troop then proceeded to make a careful search through every room, taking down to the lorries basket after basket of valuable books and manuscript, 2 lorry loads in all. It was clear from the oaths used that the names of the authors whose works were in the special library were well known to the students. Sigmund Freud, whose photograph they took from the staircase and carried off, was called that Jewish sow Freud, and Havelock Ellis was called that swine. Other English authors wanted by them were Oscar Wilde, Edward Carpenter, Norman Hare, and also the works of Judge Lindsay, the American juvenile judge, Margaret Sanger, and Georges Sylvester Viereck, and also the French writers, works of André Gide, Marcel Proust, Pierre Loti, Zola. The sight of the works of the Danish doctor Lundbach also made them break out into oaths. Many bound volumes of periodicals were also removed. They also wanted to take away several thousand questionnaires, which were among the records. Well, they never know. A few days later, all the books and photographs, together with a large number of other works, were publicly burned on Opera Square. More than 10,000 volumes from the Institute's special library were destroyed. A bust of Hirschfeld was carried in a torchlight procession and thrown onto the fire. And there is in the book a photograph with torches showing upon the head that they were going to throw into the fire. It is very terrible. After that, there were the camps, and hundreds of thousands of homosexuals died in them, a thing that is not spoken of, the Pink Triangle. We have had our own Holocaust. I think we should learn it, study it, know it, remember, honor, beware of. And seeing that Holocaust still smoking in Briggs, know it can come back, and know that we begin again. Having come this far, having remade ourselves, we have to look at where we are. I realized that we were going through a cultural and collective explosion of change in our own lives, through which we are changing the lives of all of those around us. All of the people in California have been educated, thanks to that man, but really thanks to us and all the work that people in California did. We are at the point now of asking ourselves sort of, where are we? We are making a culture, we are making a community out of our own hassles and the through and despite them and so forth. I was given permission to talk of personal interests here. out of our own personal interests, our experiences, our resources. For me, it's kind of capitulated by this summer because a very dear friend of mine, a lover of mine, Sita, died over this summer. A very great fighter for gay rights, women's rights, Chicanos and Latinas, and did an enormous amount more probably than anyone in the California university system for handicapped persons as well, and someone who had given their whole life to this kind of struggle and had done it with such style and gallantry and as such a very brave lady, left me realizing particularly how dying through suicide against illness, against terminal cancer. How can we have built a community that really can't help anybody who has helped to build it yet enough, so that you have to die alone and under those circumstances? And out of that particular loss of my own, I decided to go ahead. First, I just couldn't do anything. But then I decided to go ahead and build what I wanted to build, and that would help rather than hinder or make me more determined. Because I think every time you lose a fellow liberationist and scholar and artist and fighter and all the people you lose, that should make you more energized, more determined, more angry and proud and oddly enough optimistic than ever. So I unleashed my terrible scheme, which is to make my farm into a women's art colony. So we're working very hard at that, and we've already converted the barns into studios. And since the whole thing is planned, and it's like I'm really 8 years old and I'm kind of like playing store half the time. I even thought it would be, you know, grand thing to make it a tree farm too, since who wants to depend on the government and rich people, you know? Got all these acres, plant the trees, so we're planting all the trees. There's something fanatical about tree planters. I can hardly even apologize for my behavior in this respect. We are going to make something that will go on and endure and give a refuge and a support and a kind of community to other women for a long time.
That was Kate Millett as the keynote speaker at the Gay Academic Union Conference in November of 1978, produced by Helene Rosenbluth. This program was preserved and made accessible thanks to a matching grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives in a project we call American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. To purchase a copy of this program or any other programs in our series, call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230 or browse our entire collection of From the Vault programs. Go to fromthevaultradio.org. And now back to Kate Millett.
I'm diving deeper, deeper for you. Down to the bottom, 10,000 emeralds.
Next, we hear an interview with Kate Millett following the release of her 1990 book, The Loony Bin Trip, with WBAI producer Mario Murillo.
Just as your physical liberty is taken from you and you are imprisoned without having broken the law or committed a crime, you are henceforward subject to any form of mistreatment, to forced drugging, to the torments of electroshock and restraint, that is, the brutality of being tied at your wrists and ankles in leather cuffs that perform the function of shackles. This is drastic stuff.
Author and artist Kate Millett, addressing the North American Support and Counter Conference to the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting on May 15, 1990. The Counter Conference was called in order to break the silence on psychiatric oppression and to call for truly humane alternatives for emotional support which respect the rights and dignity of each individual. At the conference, Millett and other advocates for the victims of psychiatry debated doctors and representatives from the American Psychiatric Association, with the main thrust of the discussions being the myths of psychiatry. In Kate Millett's latest book, the author of Sexual Politics divulges her horrifying experience as a twice-committed manic depressive. The Loony Bin Trip details in dramatic fashion the pain of solitary confinement, forced doses of thorazine and lithium, physical abuse, and emotional terror of trying to convince others and herself that she was not mad. In The Loony Bin Trip, Kate Millett not only provides us with a rare view of the life of a former mental patient, but reminds us of the ever-important issue of individual freedom versus societal norms.
The American Psychiatric Association met in New York, you know. 14,000 psychiatrists, $40 million for the conference. The drug companies pay for it. They also pay for the journals. You know. During the APA meetings, it's always been traditional for the movement against psychiatry to get together somehow, often to demonstrate against, which we did too. But the emphasis this year was on making a counter-conference. The emphasis is really on building an anti-psychiatric movement so that all sorts of different groups, factions even, you might say, all united and cooperated. And people from all over the country came and stayed in the city at the youth hostel uptown. And they had their own workshops, their own conference. And I think we were a big success, too. Mm-hmm. You see, there's a whole spectrum, actually, between and where the split came when it came and so forth, was there's a sort of a theoretical anti-psychiatric spectrum in this movement. And then there's another spectrum which is interested in alternative healing of all kinds. That is, beginning, say, with ex-inmates giving each other support, which, of course, is a very, very necessary part of it. It's like consciousness raising and so forth in the women's movement. So you've got the sort of theoretical side and the healing side. And then certain people in the healing side then manage to set up centers, drop-in centers, or to cooperate with Protection and Advocacy, which is a federal program. Or other National Institute of Mental Health programs to set up various self-help groups and to actually enter the system through functioning as protectors and advocacy under the Protection and Advocacy Law, which the federal government set up. The federal government's intention, of course, was probably a whitened sepulcher. I mean, after all, the mandate is to protect the rights and advocate for those who had mental illness. Well, of course, once you go along with this mental illness business, you aren't going to have any rights, so one can hardly advocate for them. And it didn't say those who are stigmatized by mental illness or have been so designated or labeled or anything. So that there's a lot of social work and young idealistic law that goes into the whole protection and advocacy thing. And a great many of them really believe in mental illness. So, in other words, then you really believe in what the doctor says. So how can you, as an attorney, oppose psychiatry in order to protect your client's rights? You're in a bag, pretty much the way public defenders are at commitment trials, which take about 2 minutes, and the person's drugged, and the public defender thinks they're crazy too because the psychiatrist said so, and he's a doctor.
So in a sense, this whole thing is pretty revolutionary in the sense that you have to completely disregard a whole mental illness. You have to disregard that before you can actually approach it in terms of dealing with it. You have to disregard the whole fundamental way society thinks about something that's existed for years.
I don't think you start out that way. I didn't. And I arrived there logically. I really had to give up the idea of mental illness in order to make even a good case for the human rights of mental patients. But there's also a wide spectrum of how much people really have eschewed the idea of mental illness. And particularly at one end of the spectrum where there's a cooperation with community health care and anything funded by the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, where one is a recipient of government funds, one is compromising. So you can see that there's a spectrum between that and, say, the people who are chiefly interested in theory, as I am, and other members of the movement. I think in our position we see no purpose in taking government money because it involves intellectual compromises, which are not just matters of principle, they're reality too. You know, the question of mental illness and mental disease sounds like a very theoretical kind of question, but if psychiatry, remember the old illusion and reality we used to get in college English class, you know, although psychiatry is illusion, loony bins are reality. Four-point restraint is a reality. Psychotropic drugs are a reality. What, you know, umpteen years of Haldol will do to give you tardive dyskinesia. That's an irreversible disease of the central nervous system, which is one of those diseases called iatrogenic. That is, it's induced by medicine and not by natural circumstances. Mm-hmm. Well, those are realities. Psychiatry has poisoned a lot of people, given a lot of people tardive dyskinesia through its drugs, and it's wasted the lives of ever so many people.
Like some of the drugs, if you could name them. Prozac, I heard about Prozac.
Yeah, well, one of its side effects is it can kill you, which is a side effect of a lot of them. If you read the description of these drugs in the physician's desk reference, it's very grim reading. Thorazine, Stelazine, Haldol, they are all the drugs that give tardive dyskinesia. Prolixin, one of the most terrible drugs that I've ever been subjected to. Terrible nightmares.
What kind of impact did it have on you? How did it affect you?
A lot of them really are hallucinogenic in a sense. You have to hold on very, very hard to your powers of reasoning. They really assault the mind. They really assault your ability at rational thinking, at, you know, making sentences and
but
logic. They really destroy your mental capacity at the moment when you need it, probably more than you've ever needed it in your life.
But at the same time, it's meant to
it's
do the quite opposite.
It's supposed to be anti-hallucinogenic and so forth. But what they really do is they shut you up. They're kingpin tranks. It is so hard to think under them. It is so hard to talk. When you take Thorazine, your tongue swells up, your throat's on fire. There are all kinds of side effects, like you can't sit still. You have muscle jerk and spasm. You're in hell. Really, the thirst is just, it's indescribable how uncomfortable and horrible it is. You're a raging fever. The mind is invaded by a foreign substance. You aren't just a physical prisoner. They have also managed to, you know, assault your immortal soul. Remember, four walls do a prison make, but mm-hmm. we can keep our souls. Well, this new Inquisition has invaded the mind, too. Mm-hmm. That's one of the very worst things about this kind of imprisonment, is that you don't have the refuge of your own mind. Because they've invaded its inviolable sanctity, which is really a very precious idea.
And how do you convince people otherwise?
Well, I suppose if you're going to discuss drugs, it's the person who might know about them is the one who's swallowed it. It seems to me it ought to be de rigueur for psychiatrists to try this stuff themselves, for one thing, to see what it does to mental capacity.
The reason why it's ironic, you know? Because, and this may be insensitive, but I mean, these things you're saying, you know, the jerking reaction and the inability to speak and your throat gets all dry. Mm. I mean, these are characteristics that people stereotypically think, oh, they're crazy.
Yeah.
So when you're taking these drugs,
you're given symptoms.
Exactly.
And if you have tardive dyskinesia and, like, have those jerks, you know, that kind of spasm, yeah, you do look crazy. You aren't going to get a job. They'll notice you in the waiting room and all that kind of thing. And dry mouth and so forth. So often, too, I took lithium for ages, and its side effects are dry mouth, hand tremor, diarrhea. These are all the symptoms of what? Intimidation, fear, insecurity, anxiety, being scared. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, you're tranked about three notches down, so that it's harder to think, you're slower on the uptake.
But I think
you can get flustered very easily. Mm-hmm. They're the mental state of those who are suborned and cowed, and they've induced this chemically.
Hmm. I mean, physically, those are a lot of the characteristics, but I mean, in the book, when you're trying to convince yourself that you don't need the lithium, just explain that whole process of not only the physical side effects, but also the mental and emotional side effects of what this does to you.
Well, you see, in taking it, you're complicit with what you hope is a lie. That is, you want to be sane. You want to be of whole mind. But they told you you weren't. They've also hospitalized you, broken you in half. You experience enormous dejection and grief. It's easy to call that depression. And after all, isn't the logical hookup manic depression? So while you're certain you were never manic, you are now very depressed. So you have also been isolated and estranged from everybody you know or care about. You've lost probably the place where you live, all your money, all your connections. And you don't have any support. You don't have a movement. So to stay alive and to live, to continue to live, rather than, say, execute the disease of the sentence of execution and suicide, which is kind of inherent in this. After all, you've been diagnosed as having an illness that's sort of like AIDS or terminal cancer or something. You know, it's a chronic degenerative disease. You're going to be in 10, 20 years over there in a corner gibbering, you know. This is what you got to look forward to. Who the hell wants to live this way? So a lot of people kill themselves behind this kind of diagnosis. So they're responsible for a lot of deaths, too. Mm-hmm. Well, in the absence of a movement or support or any kind of organized opposition to this sort of social control, as an isolated individual, you somehow or another, if you don't want to die, and you're not strong enough to be the only person in the whole world who believes what you believe or something, or oppose all by yourself science, you make some compromise with that. So you then go and take medication. But all this time, you know it's a crock. Part of you knows it's a crock. After 7 years of knowing this, I decided I'd try it out. I wasn't sure. You know, maybe they were right. I really was crazy and so forth. Maybe I'd fall apart in no time and all that. I made a big mistake, however. I told other people. You see, the second time I went off lithium, I never told anybody, and no one ever noticed anything at all. But the first time, I told people, and the power of suggestion was fantastic. Mm. Within no time at all, I was exhibiting symptoms. Because what you're dealing with is a kind of lay religion. It's a general superstition. To one extent or another, people all believe in this system.
Why don't we take one step back and explain why did you have to get into it anyway? What happened to you personally that you went on to lithium and that you...
Well, why would I ever, you know, want to go along with this? And I certainly didn't in the beginning. I was working on a civil rights case. I think we even tried to talk on BAI about it. When Michael Malik was executed in Trinidad, I and some other people were trying to save him from this execution. And we were working on it very hard. I went to England to get press sympathy for him because Trinidad was a crown colony then. And the family decided I was spending too much money by buying an airplane ticket to England. My money, but still. I wasn't a kid. I was 38 years old. But I had an elder sister who wanted to interfere in my affairs, and she dared me to see a psychiatrist because she thought I was obsessed with his case or that I was over my head or needed help or whatever the phrase is they use. So I thought I'd be making an office visit, you know, orange furniture, bad pictures, the usual plans, California. Instead, it was a locked facility. I didn't have a chance. It was a trap. Lots and lots of people get institutionalized this way. They're deceived into it. Then you got to deal with how you feel about those people and what they did to you. You know, that took a long time working it out between me and my elder sister, who is now a real attorney and respects mental patients' rights, but didn't that day. And the doctor who admitted me, I mean, no one's turned away for being sane after all, he said my only mistake was in trusting the people who brought me there. And yeah. A very cruel little last ring laugh. I managed to get out of there through perjuring myself and signing a paper saying I was voluntary, which by God I wasn't. And of course it was a very long risk. I couldn't get a lawyer. And I saw no way of ever getting out of there at all. So I also realized that they wanted to let me go because they thought they had a little maybe more than they could handle ultimately in me. And I might make trouble. So they said they'd cut a deal. If I'd sign a paper saying I was voluntary, they'd let me out. Of course, in signing that paper, I lost all my rights because then they could do anything to me and said I had volunteered for it. But they did let me out. At this point, you know, your life is broken up into a bunch of pieces. I go back to New York. Everybody I know thinks I've had a nervous breakdown. Well, I'm smart. I'm a writer or something. It's supposed to be, you know, a little cachet in that, you know. I say, no, wait a minute, you know. You won't believe what my elder sister did in her, you know, infinite unwisdom. And I was in a terrible place and fed terrible drugs. But everybody thinks it's for your own good. And if you're irascible and angry about it, it's only, you know, further proof that and so on. So in the process, I lost my loft, my husband, my friends, and my fair name, my credibility. Every place, everybody believed that I had lost my reason.
How about yourself? I mean, because part of it is not only convincing the people, but yourself as well, as it shows in the book. You are always constantly trying to reason it out within yourself.
Yeah. I didn't, but I went into a tailspin. I mean, I had the blues, like, big time. I really didn't see much point in living. I really considered suicide. A friend of mine sniffed out that this was in the wind and said, well, you know, call that plan A, try plan B. Try plan B was to go to New York University Hospital and take lithium. Well...
now this
at
was
this
how,
point,
how
I would have swallowed
after?
Anything.
Now, this was how much longer after?
Oh, for 3, 4, 5 months. Mm-hmm. At this point, I was so traumatized by the hospitalization, by its effect on my life, by having my whole life broken in two, that I could confuse that grief with depression, which they said is an illness. If you've got depression, you've got this bipolar thing of a jig, you know, affective illness and so forth. And it's a kind of a logical trap. All this time, I was swallowing the lithium kind of on Pascal's bet, you know, like, if there's a God, I won't be badly off, and if there isn't, what have I got to lose, and so forth. But after 7 years of doing this, going along with what I felt was a really intellectually suspect proposition, which also made me a person without full reasoning powers, a thing I really didn't want to assent to, I decided to go off it. Then I fell into, like, everybody's notions again. And it wasn't till I went off it and didn't say a word that I could prove to myself, yeah, it really is nonsense. And I had been a fool of this system all along, too. Mm-hmm.
Now, when the book opens up, the on the farm, this is when you did tell people that you were off the lithium.
Yeah, alas, yeah.
So, naturally, that was another mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Want to talk about that?
In no time at all, I was exhibiting symptoms. And then you're spoken to as if you're 12 years old. You know, people patronize you. And if you're irritated at that, that irascibility is a symptom, too. By this time, they're looking stuff up in books and calling on the phone to experts. And here's our little utopian community invaded by the general, you know, virus of belief in psychiatry, which is, you know, the lay religion of this country. I could see all of my credibility with the people there just chipped away, chipped away, chipped away. As if, you know, we said, look, you see that person over there in the corner? They're really a CIA agent. And everything they do, you know, whether they scratch their nose or cough or laugh or anything, all further proof that they're a CIA agent. You're dealing with superstition. You're dealing with magical thinking.
Mm-hmm. But it must have an impact. I mean, obviously, it has an impact on how you think about yourself.
What my friend George Ebert, who founded the Alliance up in Syracuse, another one of the groups in the support in, he calls it the death of the soul. The period of isolation and grieving and despair that you feel behind this general doubt and persecution and contempt and scapegoating others, and is one of the most painful things in the world.
Well, here I'm, Peter in a hand dance, her claws still swing, and the time with the wind.
You're listening to a conversation with feminist author and artist Kate Millett, author of the book The Loony Bin Trip, an account of her experiences with forced hospitalization and drugging, all in the name of mental illness. The music you've been listening to is Not Be All Right by Mary Margaret O'Hara on Virgin Records.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres with support from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part from Pacifica Station listeners like you. Current preservation projects are funded in part by grants from the Grammy Foundation and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more, please visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
Comunitaria a través del 90.7 FM KBOO Portland y en línea a través de KBOO.FM.